Okay, I will invite you. Well, I will introduce you first. So today we are going to have a talk from Raffaele, who is visiting us from Paris. And he will be telling us about the weak scale as a trigger, part one. So crouching tigers and hidden dragon. As we know, the first part of the movie was great. So we know, we think the first part of the talk will be good too. Raffaele.
Thanks. So, well, thank you very much for the invitation and the kind introduction. I'm just disappointed I couldn't be there in person, but hopefully it will happen soon. Let me, before starting, turn off the video because we had some technical issues before. My bandwidth is not that great. All right. So, so as the title vaguely suggests, I'm going to talk about a new solution to the hierarchy problem within the framework of trying to solve the problem using cosmology. And in this story, during inflation, patches that don't have the observed value of the X vacuum expectation value will rapidly crunch. And so there is a multiverse today, but it looks like a multiverse completely dominated by the weak scale. Before getting into the details of the story, I have a very basic introduction on the hierarchy problem prepared, which you are more than welcome to ask me to skip, but I feel it's good for younger people, given that the attitude of the community on the problem.
No, continue, Raffaele. Okay. Just give your talk as you intend to give it. So.
All right.
Okay. Awesome.
Then okay, I lead you with my propaganda on the hierarchy problem, hoping that it will not spark too much controversy, but if it does, I'm happy to take it on. All right, so I would say that the most basic definition of a fine-tuning problem is that you have a theory and you compute some observable, and in your theory, this observable is the sum of multiple contributions. Then you measure the observable and you find that the experimental result is much, much smaller than two of the contributions that you could compute in your theory, which hopefully have opposite signs so that they happen to cancel each other. So this is what I would call a fine-tuning problem. So you have two or more contributions to an observable that a priori are completely unrelated, and you find that for some reason they cancel to very high accuracy to give you the observed result. Historically, these kind of problems have already presented themselves, and every time they had a very strong impact on our understanding of nature. So we started thinking about the problem, and then the solution turned out to teach us something completely new about the theory of fundamental interactions. And here I've chosen just two examples. There are many more. These are maybe the most striking, and they're also the most different from each other. So there is the story of the electron self-energy that I'm sure that you're all familiar with. Essentially, if you take a sphere around the electron and classically compute what's the energy in the electric field, you'll see that as you squeeze this sphere, this energy starts to diverge. And so at some point, you hit a conundrum. So why do you see that the electron mass is an MeV if in principle you can squeeze this sphere much past 1/(1/MeV) and get a bigger rest energy for the electron? The second problem that I will use as an example in this introduction is not traditionally considered a fine-tuning problem, because in reality it's not even a problem, it's just an interesting curiosity. So when Kepler published his Mysterium Cosmographicum, which was his best known work on the orbits of planets, you notice that if you take the Platonic solids and you put them in a certain order, you can then draw spheres around these solids, and all the planets seem to sit exactly on these spheres. And this was true within the experimental errors of the time, which were already pretty good because Tycho Brahe and the generation before Kepler had done pretty amazing measurements. And so this looks like a striking coincidence. Why are the orbits of planets tuned to sit exactly on these spheres that you can build around a very precise nesting order of Platonic solids? And okay, the explanation that Kepler gave was that it was the work of God. Today we know better, and we also know better about the electron self-energy. So both problems have a known historical resolution, and I would say that both resolutions are pretty paradigm shifting in their own way. So in the case of the electron self-energy, well, as you keep squeezing the sphere, at some point you're going to make a positron, and this happens exactly at the scale of the electron mass. And so essentially quantum field theory kicks in, a new particle appears, and together with this new particle also a symmety appears, which is the chiral symmetry that protects the electron mass. And that's how the problem is resolved, by a new symmetry and even a new understanding of particle interactions to quantum field theory. In the case of Kepler's, let's call it mystery, the resolution is in some sense simpler, but not less striking. The answer is just that this kind of approximate accidents might happen because there are a lot of solar systems. We're not looking at a single instance, but at a huge landscape of different realizations. So it might happen that something like this is realized in one of these realizations. And I would say that the resolution is simpler, but equally striking, because of course, to a man at the time of Kepler would have been an interesting, well, maybe before Kepler, but I mean, to a man in ancient ages, it would have been a huge surprise to know that we're not in any way special, we're not at the center of the universe, and we're not even remotely unique, but just a random instance of many other accidental solar systems. All right, so if you forgive me for the very, very rough historical account with some anachronistic elements, I will move forward. But I hope that this convinces you that it's at least interesting to think about these kind of problems, if anything, for historical reasons, because they typically lead to interesting discoveries. And
I didn't understand what we learned, from the Kepler thing.
Well, from the Kepler thing was a bit of an a posteriori kind of solution. I mean, we've learned that we're not the only solar system in the universe. We didn't learn it directly through thinking about the problem, but I just wanted to make a connection because, sorry.
No, I mean, go on.
No, I was drinking some water because I've been talking also right before the beginning of the talk. So I was saying that that you're right. I mean, it's a stretch to say that by thinking directly about this, we found that we were not alone. I'm just saying that if you consider it a problem, it has a very interesting resolution. But mechanically, that's not how we got to the resolution.
What's the resolution? The fact that there's the fact that there's lots of stars doesn't explain how come the orbits in our solar system are spaced that way, does it?
Well, the resolution is that it's an accident. It's an approximate accident. Of course, with data today, we know that the orbits are not exactly like that, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's an accident whose probability is order one if you see how many other solar systems there are. That's what I was trying to say. That's it.
Yeah, but it's not order one for us to live in that solar system that happens to be that way.
Sure. That's true. But I mean,
okay.
I would still consider. I mean, at this point, you want also to estimate what's the probability of having observers in general, which I'm not sure exactly how to estimate. So it might still be order one for us to live in such a solar system, depending on how many observers there are in the rest of the universe.
Right. Yeah. But there might actually be physics there, right? You know, because it's possible that the planets got packed as closely as you can pack them.
But it's also true that, this construction in some sense is scale invariant, right? So you can stretch it as much as you want and you still have the approximate coincidence that I talked about, but then the planets are not any more packed enough to give you this environmental effect.
Sorry, can you repeat? What do you mean by scale invariant here?
So I mean that you can change. So let's say that you multiply the radius of all these spheres by a common number, and you change this number.
Yeah.
You are spanning different solar systems where the argument that Neil was making might not be true.
I don't know if you can do that though, because it's not scaling invariant, right? The size of solar systems, the size of stars is determined by macrophysics. It's not a scale invariant statement. I don't know what you mean by scale invariant.
No, but I'm just trying to say that putting these spheres one inside the other doesn't determine how close the planets are to each other. So you still have some margin. You can still change this parameter. Okay, you cannot change it by orders of magnitude, but is it clear or?
Maybe we should move on.
We should continue because we don't want.
I mean, this is not super relevant to the talk anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So it's important to stay here.
Yeah. No, but I'm just saying that the fact that they are one inside the other in these solids is not fixing the distance between the planets. It's fixing the ratios of the distances.
Yeah, you know, but those ratios tell you the ratios of the orbital periods, the frequencies, right? You know, and those frequencies might be constrained, you know, because if they're too close to each other, then the planets interact with each other, right? You know, there might be physics there, which is not...
Sure. That's possible. I mean, but
anyway, yeah, but it's not relevant.
Yeah. No, it could make the solution even more interesting. I mean... I aimed for the simplest possible explanation, and maybe I'm even wrong, and there is an even more interesting one. But anyway, okay, let's move on, and let's get to another few propaganda slides again on the hierarchy problem itself now. So now we move on from this historical introduction, and we start thinking about the Higgs boson mass itself. So this is a problem that's rooted in something pretty fundamental in physics, which is in some sense just dimensional analysis. So there is a simple set of tools that allows us to derive simplified low energy descriptions from more complex UV theories. And this is based on the technique of integrating out degrees of freedom. This is the way we understand renormalization in modern terms. We understand why the standard model appears to have a bunch of accidental symmetries. And also it's a tool that we use routinely at hadron colliders to make precision predictions in QCD, resumming logarithms, for example. And also it has given us interesting dualities between quantum field theories by integrating out stringy degrees of freedom. So it's really a powerful tool in particle physics that is pervasive, and it spans fields that go way beyond particle physics itself. You can use it to get improved predictions for gravitational waves in black hole spirals. I'm thinking about the amplitude techniques by the Caltech and UCLA groups. In condensed matter, of course, is ubiquitous. I'm just citing here a famous example that encompasses superconductors and normal conductors. It's been recently proposed to improve our calculations of structure formation to compare with future large-scale structure surveys. And of course, if we go back to particle physics, there are countless applications, including, for example, chiral perturbation theory in QCD. So this is a tool that in some sense is at the base, it's really defining the foundation of how we understand particle theory in general, and also some other fields. And if you take this kind of set of techniques and try to apply it to the theory of particle interactions with, we know, plus gravity, you immediately find that your naive, at least your first naive prediction is very off compared to what we observe. So you get a cosmological constant that gives you a size of the universe that is 60 orders of magnitude smaller than observed, and an Higgs boson mass, which is 10 to the 16 times larger than observed. And these results are not based on some detail of this procedure of integrating out or some very subtle aspect of the techniques used, but they're just really based on the simplest building block, which we use every day, which is dimensional analysis, or said in a fancier way, it's the selection rule of the deletion operator. So it's just symmetry. So there is this big puzzle facing us in modern particle theory. And people, of course, have been thinking about it and they've been coming up with some different solutions. I try to classify them in broad sets. Of course, it's this classification is very debatable, but it's just to give you an idea that there are not that many conceptually different ways to solve the problem. You can imagine that there are new particles and so a new symmetry close to the scale of the Higgs boson mass, like in the electron case. You can just imagine that for some reason, gravity is associated to a mass scale that is different from the Planck scale, but it's much lower. You can imagine that the universe is just one of many causally disconnected ones where the cosmological constant and the Higgs boson mass are changing. And maybe there is an anthropic selection mechanism that is explaining why we exist in one that appears unlikely. And then there are a bunch of more modern solutions based on dynamics in the early history of the universe, or this unnaturalness is the closest thing to having many solar systems and being in a special one by accident. Finally, I listed a sixth one, but it's just works, and I don't really know any example. This gravity does not compute in a Wilsonian way, I think. I mean, I personally don't know of any example of this except in two dimensions, but in two dimensions, gravity is very different from 4D and there is no obvious way of generalizing it. So I'm just gonna keep it with an asterisk for now and not consider it a full-fledged solution. The reason why I showed you this list is because what I'm gonna talk about next uses elements of many of these existing solutions. So there is going to be asymmetry, which is going to play a crucial role in stabilizing the Higgs mass. There is going to be a multiverse with different values of the Higgs mass. And finally, there is going to be dynamical selection at some early time in the history of the universe. And this is based on a paper with Chabachaki, Michael Geller, and Hamid Ismail that appeared a few months ago. Okay, so now let's get to it. The basic idea is very simple. So as I just said, there is a landscape of different Higgs vacua. So the Higgs mass squared is scanning and it takes different values in different patches of the universe. And in some patches, it has the observed value. So close to the weak scale, this V is about 170 GeV. What our mechanism does is essentially generate a potential such that all the patches where the XVEV is not within a certain range, close to the observed value, crunch very rapidly. So they crunch in the time that I've written up there, which depends on the cutoff of the theory, which is typically very high, not exactly at the Planck scale, but relatively close. So these universes where the XVEV doesn't have a value close to the observed one, essentially, you can imagine that they don't exist or they exist for an extremely short time. And so today, after inflation, the patches that
sorry, can I ask you why are you disregarding those universes?
What do you mean? Why am I disregarding those universes?
The crunching universes.
Yeah, they. I'm not disregarding them. I'm just saying that they survive a very short time and they don't inflate.
Okay, so what? I mean, they're still there. And if you have some sort of eternal inflation that populates.
Ah, yes, of course. There is.
Then, yeah, so you need to. So why are they disregarded? The multiverse does not look like this, the picture that you have there now.
The multiverse does look like this because there is no eternal inflation in my multiverse. I'll show you in a few slides.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the point. All right, so so today, everything that survives are patches with the observed value of the XBAB or close to it, and they inflate and they become the universe that we observe today. So, okay, so how do we do it? It's relatively simple. So we imagine that there is a new scalar that I'm going to call Chi because it's going to be the dilaton of a spontaneously broken CFT or equivalently the radian of a 5D ADS construction. And this scalar Chi is coupled to the X. So in absence of the coupling to the X, it has a very deep minimum, which we are imagining it has an energy density that is larger than any other scale in the theory. So it's larger than the cutoff of the landscape scanning the CC, is larger than Hubble at inflation, is larger than the cutoff on the X sector. It's just the biggest energy scale in the theory. And then if the XBAB is in a certain range, there is another minimum, which is metastable but long deep, which is generated close to the origin. And the rest of the talk essentially will be an explanation of how this other minimum is generated.
Sorry, you still have a way, you still need to scan the cosmological constant and the XBAB. So there are other fields that do that for you. There's other fields.
Yes, there is other fields
you're not showing.
That we don't, that I'm not gonna specify.
So how do you know the vacuum structure of those fields?
Yeah, so I'm just assuming that that the cutoff of that sector is lower than the scale of this minimum. That's all I'm imagining.
But does that, so why? I mean, is that enough?
Yeah, that's enough because the biggest cosmological constant that you can have in this landscape of vacua is smaller than the vacuum energy at the deep minimum. So if you end up here, you crunch. That's all you need essentially. And then, okay, then the cosmological constant in this story is tuned. So I'm imagining that you see the right cosmological constant in this minimum as a consequence of tuning.
Yeah, but then how, okay, why don't you continue?
Sure. Okay, so.
Actually, before you go on, just to make, the assumption is that all the minima that are not this one that's the one we like are negative, is that right? So you don't have any big positive ones too?
I mean, yeah, so I'm imagining that the big positive ones are smaller than this one.
Okay.
Sorry, what does that mean? That do you have other so how does it look like?
So I'm imagining that this is the deepest minimum in the landscape.
So what? I mean, if you have other minima, those could be eternally inflating. You could be stuck there. I mean, even if they're
Again, as I said at the beginning, I'm also building the model in such a way that there is not going to be eternal inflation. So there is another separate sector of the landscape.
But how can you build that model without knowing the full vacuum structure of the theory?
I mean, you just need to imagine that it's decoupled from the scalar and that the maximum vacuum energy that it can scan is smaller than this value. That's it. That's all you need to imagine. Then if classical rolling in this potential that I'm showing you wins over diffusion.
But that's the point. Classical rolling in this potential is not the only thing that can happen.
No, okay. This potential is always there in every minimum of the landscape. I mean, I don't understand fully your confusion.
No, maybe I need to think about it.
The minima in the landscape are always the minima in the big landscape that you're not seeing times this guy. So whenever you choose a minimum, you're choosing where all the other fields are in their potential, and then you choose where this guy is in his potential.
I don't know that you don't choose the order where you pick things.
Sure.
I can add. I can change the other.
Okay. Okay. Let me say it another way. So this guy has to be somewhere in his potential. Okay. Do we agree on this?
Sorry. Which guy? Kai.
K. sky, yes.
Let's say it's sitting there, but I can add, in order for you to get some sort of other minimum there, you need to add some sort of additional.
Yes, and then saying that the contribution to the vacuum energy of all the other fields, it's subdominant to the contribution of the vacuum energy of chi in this minimum.
How do you
know that? That's an assumption. So if you assume this, then all you care about, I mean, if chi is close enough to this minimum, you're going to crunch independently of where you are in the rest of the landscape. This is an assumption that we're making, but once you make it, then it just works. You might tell me that this is not very generic. This is not a generic landscape, and I would agree. But
yeah, I don't know how to, because it looks like you have defined something that can only be negative in your case.
I need only to choose a scale. I mean, if I'm saying that the rest of the landscape cannot scan the CC more than the energy density in this minimum, I'm done.
But then how do you end up with something that has small cosmological constant at the origin?
Because the origin is at a TeV. So the contribution to the energy density of the minimum at the origin is order TeV to the fourth. So the scanning in the rest of the landscape is more than enough to give you zero there. It just cannot give you zero here. But that's fine, because I mean we're never gonna be here, otherwise we have already crunched.
I don't want to derail you too much either, but I think that the spirit of these questions is just to understand what's being designed into the potential. And so I get that you've got a minimum that's as negative. And your goal is only to solve the hierarchy problem, right? You're not trying to solve the cosmological constant problem.
Exactly.
Right. And so how much are you tuning at the origin there? When you say that the Higgs is light near the origin.
Yes. So how much am I tuning the CC or?
No, the Higgs, let's just say we'll be happy to tune the cosmological constant, but are you, how much do you have to tune the Higgs mass at the origin?
Yeah, so I'm tuning both in the usual way. So there is a landscape which is scanning both the CC and the Higgs mass. Okay. And if you want to imagine that they have a common cutoff for simplicity, this needs to be lower than the scale of the potential at the deep minimum. That's it. So, I mean, actually, if you want, I can even write down a model for you in which this happens. So imagine a simple field theory landscape, like the one in Nimas and Shamit's and Savas's paper on friendly landscapes. Okay, so imagine that the landscape is just a bunch of Mexican huts. Okay, so this landscape can scan the CC, and if you couple it to H squared, it can also scan the X mass. And this landscape is completely decoupled from chi. Modulo corrections due to gravity or to small perturbative corrections from the Higgs. So at zeroth order, you can just imagine that there are a bunch of Mexican huts that don't talk to each other, right? And so all you need to imagine for this to work is that the minima of the other scalars are less deep than the minimum of this one.
I guess my question, and maybe you're going to answer it in the talk, so I should just let you, I can ask again later on, but my basic question is, if you're happy to tune things at the origin to get your mechanism to work, why weren't you happy to tune it to get the hierarchy problem to work? So I think you're going to make some progress, but I don't see what it is yet. So maybe, I can ask it again at the end if I'm not happy at the end.
The short answer is that, I'm tuning for both, but I'm not using anthropics to select the Higgs mass. So I'm using something that to me appears cleaner, which is that the universe exists for a very, very short time if the X is not the right value, instead of invoking these more detailed arguments about chemistry that you typically do in anthropics. This is what we're buying, so full disclosure.
Okay, thanks.
No problem.
Yeah, it's not, I'm telling you exactly what I find confusing in this picture, sure. Is that it looks like by writing this effect potential out to some very high scale where the potential is very hi, you're assuming that the whatever has this, it looks like you're you have one sector that you assume has a scanning and has a different cutoff than this theory that you want to study now.
I mean, it's
higher, and this theory has a higher cutoff than the other stuff. So it's a bit, landscape. I mean,
you just need them to be weakly coupled. I mean, it's very simple in reality, right? I mean, let's say that you have a theory whose cutoff is, I don't know, maybe when I'll say the numbers, it will seem...
Why don't you continue? Don't you continue? Because we're getting stuck in... Yeah.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, the numbers are not as dramatic as you might think. I mean, this guy maybe has a minimum at 10 to the 10 GV, and the cutoff on the rest of the landscape is maybe a factor of 100 less or something like that.
Okay, why don't you continue?
So, okay, yeah. For that to happen, I mean, you just need these two sectors to be weakly coupled. All right, so I've already talked about this slide. An interesting thing in general is that whenever you do this kind of, whenever you play this kind of games to try to select the X-BEV with cosmological dynamics, you always have an irreducible prediction in some sense, which is that there is a scalar whose mass is the weak scale squared divided by its BEV. So if you have some symmetry that protects its BEV from the cutoff, it can be relatively heavy, close to the weak scale. But if you don't have any symmetry, as in the case of the relaxon, for example, or other ideas, then these guys are always predicted to be light. And it's a very simple matter of dimensional analysis to show it. So all this class of ideas has this common prediction of a light weakly coupled scalar, but only light and weakly coupled in this sense. So it depends on the cutoff. And okay, I can tell you more about this at the end if you want to hear more. Okay, so now let me tell you how we generate the potential that I described. I'm going to do it in 5D for simplicity. So I'm going to imagine that the standard model is confined to the UV brain. The only exceptions are the Higgs and electroweak bosons, which also propagate in the bulk, and a Goldberg-Weiss scalar that also propagates in the bulk and stabilizes the extra dimension. And okay, this is the usual slice of ADS that you might be familiar with from working with RS models. The dilaton or the radion, if you just solve the equations of motion, has a profile that looks peaked in the IR. And so now let's see what's the potential of this dilaton slash radion. So there is this Goldberger-Weiss piece that I'm not going to talk about too much, which is the one that's generating the deep minimum. And it has a component which is scale invariant, so this chi to the fourth, which is just coming from detuning the tension of the brains and the bulk. And then there is a piece that breaks slightly scale invariance by a small amount, which is given by the mass of this Goldberger-Weiss scalar in units of the large scale in the extra dimension.
And how big does the lambda need to be?
So you'll see that these lambdas are going to be very small. Actually, this is one of the things that I don't love about the mechanism. So these lambdas are going to be order 10 to the minus 5, but not for any reason related to the vacuum energy.
But then why do you need a dilaton at all? Why don't you just do the same with a scalar singlet, no extra dimensions, nothing?
Exactly. That's what I'm going to show you at the end. I mean, we did it this way just for, let's say, historical reasons. I mean, we did it this way only because Chubb and Michael had already done a similar thing for the CC. And I wanted to learn more about extra dimensions. So it's a purely coincidental reason why you see all this contraption. But in the last 5 to 6 slides, I'll show you how to do it in a much simpler way.
Okay.
Okay, so there is this piece that generates the deep minimum. Then, and there is nothing new about it. I mean, it's the usual story. This delta is a tiny breaking of scale invariant, so you can decouple the scale of the minimum from the scale of the exadimension, the curvature of the exadimension. Then, okay, there is the exponential, which again, it's the usual exponential, which I'm imagining is scanning in the multiverse. And this is the potential on the UV brain, which is scanning, and it's the one relevant for the web that we see, because the matter and most of the gauge bosons are stuck to the UV brain, with the exception of electroweak gauge bosons. Okay, finally, there is the interesting part, which is the one that's generating the metastable minimum. And this is given by a series of localized interactions between the X and the dilaton. You can localize them somewhere in the bulk or close to the higher brain. It doesn't really matter. Plus another interaction with the Goldberger-Wise scalar. So if you give the X a mass, say on the higher brain.
So the Higgs is also in the bulk here?
The X, yes, can propagate in the bulk. I'll show you in a second what bulk mass we're giving to the X.
And just another question just regarding the setup. So here you have RS, so you could have solved the hierarchy problem just with RS. So, yes. So is there like the set of parameters that you're going to take are going to be different than the ones that you usually take to solve hierarchy with RS?
Yeah, in the end, the difference is going to be that it's mainly going to be phenomenological, in the sense that you're going to predict a dilaton that's lighter than usual. And also no KK gluons and no KK partners of the fermions.
I see.
But again, to be honest, I also like better the version of the story with just a scalar.
Okay, thank you.
In some sense, it's cleaner. I mean, this is interesting because it's a mixture between very different techniques. So the conformal symmetry, if you want, is protecting the web of chi. And at the same time, it's also making chi sensitive to the X web, even if I'm coupling it to H squared. Instead, if I do it with a normal scalar, I will have to couple it differently, either to GG dual or I'm going to have to add a second X. So I think that the value of this model is mostly in introducing the general idea of crunching using the X web and showing that you can do it in this mixed way that as weird phenomenological predictions.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. So okay. These three terms come from localized interactions. And let me be a bit more precise, but not too much. So as I was saying, I'm letting the X have a bulk mass. And I'm taking it in such a way that the X profile is almost linear. I mean, there is no tuning here. This alpha parameter can be order 0.5, whatever you want. It doesn't matter that much. Just imagine that this is the X profile. Then if I add some, say, IR mass term for the X, the effect of the UV web on the dilaton can be just computed easily by solving the equations of motion and plugging in this X profile. Okay, you just do the calculation and you get these terms that I was showing you a few slides ago. So there is nothing particularly illuminating here. Maybe, the only interesting point is the one that I anticipated to Daniel when he asked, which is that you might worry about closing loops on the UV brain and being sensitive to the cutoff, but the warping of the exadimension itself is protecting you from this. Maybe what's slightly maybe not illuminating, but slightly easier to understand is this picture in 4D. So in 4D, we have a CFT, which is broken at the dilaton web, roughly. But the standard model is not part of the CFT. It gets correction, so the X mass gets correction up to this much higher scale lambda H, the cutoff of the X sector. And then we're imagining that there are at least two operators in this CFT, one that has dimension 3 plus alpha over 2, and it's a doublet of SU2, and one that has dimension 4 plus epsilon, and it's a singlet of SU2. Then, of course, I mean, you can write down all possible interactions, and the two most important ones are these two. So there is a mixing between this doublet and the X, and there is a tadpole for this semi-marginal operator. And so if you go down at low energies and you put the X to its BEV, both these guys, I mean, the first guy is relevant and the second guy is almost marginal. So they're going to give the biggest contributions to the dilaton potential at low energy. And the way you can get the dilaton potential is essentially through dimensional analysis. So you can run the couplings lambda H and lambda epsilon to low energy and multiply everything by chi to the fourth, which is the only scale that you have at low energy. And then you're going to get exactly the potential that I was showing you before, plus other terms that are more suppressed. All right, so this is the story of how the potential is generated. Now let's see what it can do for us. So first of all, I'm going to imagine that at the very low energy minimum, the Goldberger-Wise contribution to the potential is small, mostly for simplicity, but also because if it dominates, it's going to wash out the metastable minimum. And so to see if a metastable minimum exists and the universe is quote unquote alive, I need to analyze only this mixed dilaton X potential. And already by looking at it, you get an idea of what's going on. So closest to the origin, this H to the fourth term is dominating, which is negative. So the potential is going to go down. Then this chi to the 2 plus alpha piece takes over and you start growing. And then this third negative term becomes dominant and you start going down again. So there is going to be a minimum and a maximum. Okay, but let's look at this in a bit more detail as a function of the XBEV. So if the XBEV is zero, this potential is just not doing anything for us. And you have no low energy minimum. Actually, if the XBEV is much smaller than Abelard inflation, effectively you don't care about it at all. So you need to further impose a low scale of inflation. And finally, which is probably the most interesting side of this inequality, if the XBEV is very large, then the last term in the potential dominates. So the potential is always negative and you have no minimum. So this is very schematically how you're getting this metastable minimum. Maybe I even spent too many slides on this, which is pretty trivial. The slightly more interesting part of the story is that you can compute exactly the value of the XBEV for which you lose the minimum. And it depends exponentially on these dimensions, operator dimensions. And so if you take this epsilon in particular small, you can naturally have this critical X value to be much smaller than the curvature in the extra dimension. And this is not new. Essentially, it's the Goldberger-Wise mechanism, because when epsilon goes to zero, you are recovering scale invariance. So the way in which you're generating a small scale, it's dimensional transmutation. You have something marginal that is running very slowly into the IR. And the minimum of the dilaton potential can be computed as a function of the XBEV, and essentially it's proportional to it. So again, there is the same separation of scale due to scale invariance. And you naturally expect the minimum of the dilaton to be close to the weak scale. And of course, this is a problem because at very, very zeroth order, you predict that the size of the extra dimension is 1 over 100 GeV. So in principle, you should have already seen W's and Z prime, W primes, Z primes, photons, et cetera, et cetera. So you need to tune a little bit. So this is the usual, it's like a rather common manifestation of the little hierarchy problem. You want this BEV of the dilaton to be at least a TeV, so that the first KK excitations appear around a few TeV. And to do that, you need an hierarchy between the quartic couplings in the dilaton potential. And if you do impose this hierarchy, which is forced on you by collider phenomenology, lab precision measurements, and a bunch of other indirect observations, then you end up with a prediction, with the prediction that the dilaton is a bit lighter than you would expect. So if if we had not built LAP yet, and we could write down completely natural models, this model would predict a dilaton with the same mass as the Higgs, essentially. But given what we know about nature already, we predict a dilaton that is about a factor of 10 to 100 lighter than the Higgs. And if you want to see this in more detail, here is a plot of dilaton phenomenology. This is the dilaton mass versus its mixing angle with the Higgs. The points in this scan, I mean, we didn't really need to scan. The points all fall on a line that tells you that the dilaton mass is proportional to the square root of the mixing angle, roughly. This can be computed rather easily from the potential. And you can see that there is a bunch of proposals that can already, in the next couple of years, well, maybe not couple, but in the next few years, test almost the entirety of the viable parameter space. So at lower masses, what you see in the right-hand plot, the high luminosity run of LHCb plus the proposed run of Sequest for new physics can already essentially see all the points. At high mass, you have to wait for some Z factory, but again, I mean, there is no way to hide this dilaton in the future if we build a large electron-positron collider. You can see something similar in a different plane because the photon is propagating in the bulk, as I was saying at the beginning. So the coupling of the dilaton to the photon is much larger than what you will get by just mixing with the Higgs. So again, here I'm showing two representative sets of points, which I'm not going to describe in too much detail. And again, you can see that between Bell 2, the high Lumi run of the LHC, which is this purple projection here, you can cover already a good fraction of parameter space, and with a future electron-positron collider, you're probably going to see all of it. This n equal 3 versus n equal 8 gives you a good, let's say, snapshot of what the full parameter space is. This n is the central charge of the CFT, which has upper and lower bounds. Well, the lower bound is around 3, and the upper bound is a bit larger. It's around 40, but points with 40 are already essentially excluded.
How would you know that this is, I mean, why not just take an ordinary RS model and just tune it?
Well, the main difference would be that would be the spectrum of KK resonances.
No, so, I mean, it's tuned, so everything is heavy. You don't see them.
Well, I mean, if you see only the dilaton, then you cannot distinguish it essentially from anything.
Yeah.
It could be whatever if you see only the dilaton, of course. I mean, but that's true for everything, right? I mean, if you see only a piece of the UVT, I mean, if you see...
No, I'm saying there is also these arguments about then the universe crunches and then it's tuned and then there is like... I mean, which ultimately boils down to anthropic. So why not just tune the theory you already have?
No, I mean, there is no anthropics anywhere. I don't know. I don't understand what...
No, it's an observational. You're saying we're in the universe. Why weren't we in the universe that crunched? It's observational.
Okay, I mean...
Putting an observational... Actually, the prediction of the model is that most universe have died... I mean, if you accept, because you haven't even explained how inflation works here.
Yeah, we'll tell you in a second. I mean, there is not a lot to
then
explain.
Why most the prediction is, but most universes have expired. So it's highly, why aren't we in those universes? Why are we around? You're putting an observational, it's an observational bias that you're putting in.
What's an observation? I mean, wait, can you please ask me the question again? I mean,
The question is the following. So what you're putting in is you're putting an observational bias. The prediction of the model is that most universes have crunched in the past.
No.
So you're saying that we can only be in the one that's around today.
Sure.
It's an observational bias.
What do you mean it's an observational bias?
It's an observational bias because you're saying since we are around today, we can only be living in the universe where they're very small.
No. I mean, I'm just saying that it's almost impossible to imagine that observers exist in these other universes.
Why?
They last for
Are you doing anthropics?
Time. I'm not doing anthropics.
Then how do you know it doesn't have observers?
Well, okay.
No, all right, let's...
So technically I have to think about anthropics in the end.
Yes, exactly. So yes,
it's... one cannot avoid it. It's true. When I say I'm not doing anthropics, I'm saying that I'm not doing anthropics for our universe. And I'm not saying that that the one we observe is the only one where observers can emerge.
I don't know what that means.
I honestly don't understand the object. I mean, whether I'm doing anthropics or not doesn't matter. I mean, I'm telling you how you can explain the value of the Higgs mass in the universe that we observe. That's it. I mean, the anthropics for these universes that last for a very short time are pretty straightforward. I mean, I'm not doing them in the slides, but... I mean, are you telling me that you think that observers can exist in these other universes?
I don't know.
If you tell me how you think that observers can exist in these other universes, I can answer it.
I don't understand the dynamics part. See, that's the thing. So you created a universe where...
I mean, the dynamics part is that I'm making it impossible for observers in these other universes to exist because I'm leaving them an incredibly short time. Now,
well, that's
we can look. Yeah,
you're saying that you've created a theory where there is a large.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't. Does it matter if it's anthropics or it's not anthropics? I mean, I'm saying that I'm not using the detailed anthropic argument that.
No, what I'm saying is it's not necessarily dynamics that selects this universe. It's not like you've done a measure.
It doesn't matter at all. I mean,
then the
dynamics is crunching the universe. Then.
Okay. And
yeah, then you can say that anthropics is selecting the one that we're in today, but it's not the usual anthropics. I mean, it's a much cleaner and simpler anthropic argument. I'm not asking about chemistry or how nuclei are formed or what happens if you change the Yukawas. I mean, I don't understand the objection. I mean,
well, you don't know what those parameters are in those other universes because the Higgs is much heavier. You have other fields that are scanning and you don't know how the parameters change. No, it's just that because there is a lot of work.
I can
try to see the point. How does it change the whole?
I can write an explicit model where I know what's happening also in these other universes. I mean, I can write a friendly landscape or whatever you want. I mean, I'm not doing it because it doesn't seem very important. But.
Can I ask you a very specific question? So what will you need to actually test this thing? You need to test the potential, I guess, right? To like confirm that this is the solution of the thing.
Yes, I mean, I think the easiest way would be to measure the first step would be to measure the dilaton mass and the mixing angle and see that there's, well, I didn't write it down, but there is a simple relation between the mass, the mixing angle and the X-VEB. So that's step zero. Then you want to see also how the extra dimension looks like. And then of course, the only way in the end to really test mechanisms with a landscape is to see more than one vacuum.
Okay.
No, I mean, I understand, Mina, why you're not happy. I mean, indeed, I mean, there is an anthropic element that it's always present when you think about the landscape. I mean, that's unavoidable. What I was trying to say, maybe it's just a semantic misunderstanding, but what I was trying to say at the beginning is that I don't need to rely on any specific detail of chemistry, I think, to say that observers don't exist in these other universes. Maybe you can find an example where this is not true, and I'd be happy to see.
I just don't know. I mean, maybe if everything is scaled upwards, why can we live for a very short time?
That's not impossible. That's not impossible.
There is secretly always anthropic arguments in this type of scenario, always.
No. Yeah. As I said, it's unavoidable if you have a landscape to end up discussing anthropic arguments. I mean, there is no way to avoid it. Mm. I'm just finding a way to make it easier in principle.
Yeah. I'm not sure, because it's just, you work in a little part of the multiverse where you think you can control the dynamics, but there are many dimensions. You're making several assumptions there.
Wait, okay. So first of all, I think that I've addressed your initial objection, at least. I mean, it's easy to build a model where the multiverse today looks the way I showed you. So with large universes with the observed value of the X band. Then, okay, I mean, you can say that maybe observer exists also in these tiny universes, but that's fine. I mean, it doesn't really make this model useless. I'm just saying that if you want to live in a big universe like the one that we observe today, you need to have the observed value of the X mass. I mean, I think that this is an explanation of why the X mass has the value we see now. It doesn't matter if these other universes with this very, very shortly lived observers exist. It doesn't matter at all, right? That's why I'm saying that I'm not really doing anthropics.
Okay.
Because even if these other observers exist, they exist in universes that are remotely different from ours. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. You want to say if the universe is large, then the Higgs is small.
Yeah. And I think this is already good enough and interesting, and it saves me from studying all the details of these other universes, in which, okay, there might or there might not be observers, but I don't really care. Okay, so let's see where we were at. Okay, so now I told you how to construct the model, some of the pheno, a lot of controversy on anthropics. And now let me tell you what I don't like about the model, which are the following moving parts. So first of all, you need this hierarchy of quartics. So there is one that can be order one naturally, but then you need to tune the extra dimension, as I said. So you need other quartics to be order 10 to the minus 2 of the previous one. And finally, not to wash out the low energy minimum, you need the quartics in the Goldberg-Weiss potential to be even smaller. And this is not, completely consistent, in the sense that just for the fact of being in the extra dimension, you're gonna get some correction to these quartics. And so you need a very low cutoff for these corrections. And the first thing we could come up with was to have bulk supersymmetry, which again would not mean that the standard model is supersymmetric, just that part of the electroweak sector is. So again, the phenomenology would be a bit different than usual. Finally, you might worry about universes with zero X-BEB. Because in this case, there is a region of the potential where you get stuck and you eternally inflate. And so the way in which you solve this problem is by, again, the simplest thing we could think of is to add some confining gauge group in the bulk, which gives a relevant contribution to the Dilaton potential, which effectively breaks the CFT below the scale of confinement. So below this scale, you're still rolling fast, so there is no eternal inflation. This effective mass scale is dominating over Hubble if you take Hubble small enough. And then at higher scales, the scale invariant potential is large enough to support the rest of the rolling. So yeah, these are two ingredients that make this model look more and more similar to traditional extra dimensions, and make the construction more involved. So it's, I think it doesn't really say something on the idea itself. It more says something on the fact that this is a very rough first draft of the idea. We wanted to present the basic structure without doing too much of a model building effort, especially because, well, I think that there is a much simpler way to do the same, which is the following. So you add to your theory, there's no more extra dimension, no more dilaton, no more nothing, just two scalars and another X doublet. The predictions are that these other X doublets should be below, at least one state is below the X that we observed. And the scalars are going to be ultra light for the reason that I said at the very beginning, that for the X to affect at order one their potential, their mass has to be order V squared over the VEV. And here I don't have CFTs, I don't have scale invariants, I don't have supersymmetry, I have nothing. So the VEV of these guys is ordered the cutoff of the theory. Okay, and well, you can imagine how to do it. It's super simple. You start with a generic potential for one of the scalars that has two minima. And again, I'm imagining that the deeper minimum is the deepest, I mean, it's the largest in absolute value energy scale in the story. And so if you are in one of the minimum, you don't crunch. If you're in the other one, you do. And then if you turn on the XBEV and this is too large, you lose the minimum that was safe and you roll down into the crunching minimum. So this, in some sense, gets rid of universes where the XBEV is large. If you care about those where the XBEV is zero, but in that case, you might want to do actual anthropics, because in that case, it's much easier. You just can show that atoms do not form until much, much later, until the CMB has cooled down to incredibly, to much, much lower temperatures than our sector. But let's say that you don't want to go into these details and you want to also get rid of the universes with small XBEV. And by get rid, again, I mean what we made more precise in the discussion with Mina. I mean that they live for a very short time and they never become big. Then you just add another scalar whose potential is instead dominated by the top, by a tadpole, and as a quadratic interaction with the X. So when the XBEV is zero, it rolls down and at some point it crunches. When the XBEV is non-zero, you generate a minimum close to the origin where you can survive. Okay, so I think I might have probably gone, I don't even know how much over time, because I've given the whole talk plus all the discussion. Well, so as you can see, there is a new basic idea to solve the hierarchy problem. It has a set of interesting predictions, I think, for both the extra dimensional case and this other, let's call it perturbative case. In the case of the extra dimension, I have to say that you need to work quite a bit to make it function, but I think it's still worth to think about it in case the LHC is something unexpected, like just KKW primes and no KK gluons. So it's a fun exercise, but I think that, I mean, I like this story mostly for the general idea that then you can implement in different ways, including the one I showed you at the end. Well, yeah, this is all I wanted to say. Maybe actually more than I wanted to say.
Thank you, Rafael.
No problem.
Rafael, no, I'll tell you, I now can phrase exactly my objection. There's no dynamic selection of the vacuum. Hmm. You still have a anthropic selection of the vacuum. That's the bottom line. You engineer a potential where the time where the universe is large coincides with a small Higgs there. The crunching is not enough to dismiss those vacuum. You have tons of vacuum in this theory that are like that. And you're using secret anthropic arguments to say we can only be there.
No.
So you just, there is no dynamics at all.
Let me tell you why I disagree. I mean, I thought I'd already answered this, but let me tell you again why I don't agree.
Indeed, no, but you told me that you agree with that you do anthropics. Maybe it's
no.
A more...
No, I don't do, so let me tell you. So I don't want to, so, okay. I think I said, I mean, I kind of went back and forth with this argument and I wasn't very clear. And I even contradicted myself a couple of times. So let me just say straight now that we are at the end of the talk. So there are a bunch of universes that live for a very short time, and they might very well contain observers. Okay. And what I'm saying is that I don't care if they do. The only way to get a large universe in this story is to have the XBAB that we observe.
That's that's an anthropic argument.
That's not an anthropic argument, because I'm saying that observers can exist in the other small universes.
No, but you pick...
I'm just saying, to get a universe remotely similar to the one we observe, we need the XBAB to be small. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I'm not saying that this is necessary for observers to exist.
Yeah, but that's not selected by the dynamics. That's selected. You construct a vacuum that has a vacuum structure that has one vacuum where the value of the Higgs bed and the Higgs cosmological constant being small coincide. This is what you do, right?
So what select?
You construct a potential where the Higgs bed is small at the 100 GeV, whatever, and the cosmological constant be small at the observed value coincide. This is
by accident, but not by anthropics.
What do you mean by accident?
I'm just saying that there is no way of getting the universe that we observe unless the X is small.
Good. Okay. That I
But
you're correlating. There's still
Wait.
Because you're saying you need the universe to be large.
No. I'm not saying that I need the universe to be large. I'm just saying that by accident, the universe might be large if the XBAB is small, but if the XBAB is large, the universe can never be large. That's it. I mean,
that's fine.
It's very unambitious, but it's very simple and true.
I know. Look, Ravel, you know, we wrote a paper with Jeroen for exactly the same point.
Yeah.
We never claim it was dynamic selection. You have just created a vacuum. How you populate that vacuum is a different story.
But I don't know what paper you mean the one with the landscape, the number of vacuum in the landscape.
Of course, it's exactly the same.
Yeah. So, but I don't even understand what's bothering you. I mean.
Nothing is bothering me. Just don't tell me it's dynamics, because it's not.
Dynamics is selecting the XBAB. I mean, it's dynamic. Okay. What I mean is that.
But there's no cosmological evolution
at this level, it's just, I think we're fighting about semantics. When I say dynamics, all that I mean is that the rolling of the dilaton is making you crunch. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I don't know what, maybe you, by dynamics, you mean like in supersymmetry, some symmetry selecting the
Yeah, dynamics. For me, that's dynamics.
No, I just meant, then it's just a confusion about words. I mean, dynamics, I just meant the rolling of the dilaton. So that's what I meant. So in some sense, my dynamics is the same as the relaxion dynamics, let's call it.
Yeah.
That something is rolling, and that's all I meant. The symmetry enters, but in a non-fundamental way, let's say. I mean, it enters only in the details of the 5D model, in the sense that without the symmetry, you couldn't couple the dilaton to H squared, but it's just a technical detail. So essentially the symmetry is letting you write down this model also in this special way with the extra dimension and H squared coupled to the dilaton, which you might tell me that it's ugly and that's it. I mean, so the symmetry is not central to the story, and by the dynamical part that is central to the story, just this rolling. That's what I meant. Yeah. So I think that it was just a misunderstanding on words.
Okay. Do we have other questions from people? Okay.
By the way, I'm not upset. I actually enjoy.
No, I know. Look, I'm not upset either. You know that. It's just.
Yeah.
I can't see. It's hard to do this for a distance. No, it's not that. I'm just.
Maybe actually, I should turn.
You don't sound upset at all.
Yeah. Okay.
No.
Let's thank the speaker again, and then we stop recording, and we can keep going.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.